there advocating.
For our closing panel of the day, we're for our closing panel, we're returning to the issues of policy and law that we've been discussing to some extent all day, but a chance to focus on that, and I'm turning the floor over to Preston Patton.
Thank you, Clayton. I'm going to begin with brief introductions of our panelists. To my left is Gary Albrecht, who is a fellow of the Royal Belgian Academy of Arts and Sciences, and this next position he has is the title I want someday, Extraordinary Guest Professor of Social Sciences at the University of Leuven in Belgium, and Professor Emeritus of Public Health and of Disability and Human Development at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Gary has had a distinguished career researching, writing, and teaching regarding disabilities, and now divides his time between Brussels and Boulder, and we know in which city he gets the most sunshine. To his left is Jeff Bigham, an assistant professor at the Department of Computer Science at the University of Rochester, where he heads the Rochester Human-Computer Interaction Group. Despite his youth, Jeff has written extensively regarding internet accessibility and has done groundbreaking developmental work. Our last panelist is Elizabeth Lyle, who's with the Federal Communications Commission, where she recently served as policy advisor to the Omnibus Broadband Initiative, the group that developed the National Broadband Plan. And she was managing the team's disability access work. Presently, she serves as Special Counsel for Innovation in the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. Thank you. Previously, she co-managed the FCC's commission-wide proceeding on providing access to telecommunications equipment and services for people with disabilities and has served in other senior federal government positions. Jeff, we'd like to start with you. I think most people would be surprised to learn that there are legal and regulatory barriers to making cloud computing more accessible to persons with disabilities. Here, we've been talking all day about all the great opportunities. Can you, one, give us a brief architecture lesson, and then two, talk a little bit about some of those legal and regulatory barriers?
Yes, and I'm going to go up to the slide, to the projector to do that. So as Preston mentioned, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Rochester, and for several years now, we've been thinking a lot about how to build cloud-based assistive technology. And while initially most of the considerations that we had were more on the technical constraints and what you'd actually have to do to build a cloud-based assistive technology, as we've been doing this, it's become more and more clear that there's a whole lot of other issues, both legal, policy, regulatory, that also come into play here. And these range from everything from copyright to privacy to licenses to digital rights management to all of these other things. And so what I thought I would do today is just quickly go over a number of different ways that you could architect cloud-based assistive technology kind of at a high level that may impact some of these concerns. So if we and what I'll be basically doing here is peeling away some of the fluff of the cloud that we've used as an abstraction today to not have to deal with some of its innards and how that might affect some of the policy decisions that you might want to make. Okay, so in my view of what traditional AT looks like is that it plays a pretty passive role to the cloud. The user's computer already has assistive technology on it, maybe it's installed there. And then its main interaction with the cloud, this kind of abstraction of the networks and everything else, is just in that it makes a request off to the cloud. There's some server out there that has content that it might want, so let me say the New York Times, and then that content gets delivered to the user's computer, where the assistive technology installed in that computer does something to make that content more accessible to somebody. So say it speaks the content out loud. So here the New York Times speaking out the New York Times. Some of the earliest cloud-based assistive technology did what was called transcoding. And so for this, you add this extra machine here, this, I don't know if I can put my mouse on here or not, an extra server here. And what this does is it sits in between the user and whatever content they're delivering and changes that content as it's being delivered through the cloud to make it more accessible. So for instance, the user might, again, be requesting the New York Times, but instead of just getting it directly, it goes through this extra server, which changes that content around a little bit. In our case, it's removed some of the extra just template information there on the New York Times before getting back to the client, perhaps to make it simpler, perhaps for somebody with a cognitive disability, but also maybe somebody with a visual impairment for whom going through all that extra content could be time-consuming. But again, the AT is actually on the user's computer, and it's the one that's actually responsible for converting this into speech, something that's more usable. Of course, you might think, and this is where some of these issues come in, that going through that extra machine, you know, now I'm essentially repackaging and re-delivering content that I don't own. So I'm actually taking some of this New York Times content. Briefly, it's existing on my machine, and then it's being delivered to the user. One way to look at that, though, is it's not entirely unlike what the internet, what this cloud underneath some of the fluffiness actually looks like anyway. So your content doesn't just go directly from the content provider to your machine. It actually takes a number of hops through the cloud as that happens. And so maybe this isn't all that different. And then another thing that people have explored is, do we really need this extra server running somewhere out there in the cloud? Could we just put that on the user's machine instead and have the transcoding, have this changing of content happen right on the user's machine? So maybe we bypass some of those issues again if it's happening on the client and not on this extra machine. Another thing that's happened over the last few years, as web pages have quickly morphed into these web applications, and as they have, it's become more feasible to push more of the AT functionality out into the cloud. One of the simplest forms of this that we saw was that the user's computer doesn't necessarily have to have assistive technology installed on it beforehand. Instead, out there in the cloud, the AT program can exist, and the user's computer can go out and get the assistive technology, run it on their machine, and then get that extra content and speak it, for instance. And so the difference here is that the AT wasn't pre-existing on the user's machine. It existed somewhere out in the cloud. They could go after it and get it onto their machine. From any computer, potentially, or at least the computers that they have permission to run this extra program on. Okay, so we can also deliver code that runs right in the user's browser, which lets the software run on any web-enabled device without special permissions. So someone mentioned the libraries in the last panel. So in the libraries, they don't necessarily let you just run any software you want or install any software you want, and so you might want to make the sacrifice of running that software instead of in the computer's native environment in the web browser. And so it gets complicated, though, because a lot of the most interesting assistive technology can't actually run entirely within the browser sandbox. For instance, we can't currently produce speech from text within the browser sandbox. And as a result, I and others started building assistive technology that exists somewhere in the middle. So interactive code that runs on the client in the browser, which can run anywhere without special permissions, using services out on the web that do things like convert text to speech. And so we heard about mashups a couple panels ago. This would be an interesting example of that. And so the visualization here is Web Anywhere is one of these web-based cloud ATs that we've developed. So the user, who has nothing special installed on their machine from the start, first makes a request out to the cloud, and in their web browser loads Web Anywhere, this AT. They use that AT to get the content that they're interested in, so in this case, the New York Times. And then because we can't convert text to speech right in the browser, instead we go out to this other service, we request this text that we want, it gets sent back to the browser where it's spoken, right there within the constraints of the browser. And just as yet another variation on this, we can also consider what happens when we push the full browser and maybe even some traditional assistive technology, all of that into the cloud. And so here we have a machine with a browser, has some AT on it. And we're going to add in this extra component where we're going to separate physically the machine that has the browser and the AT on it from the user who's actually using this browser and AT. So we have a thin client out somewhere else on the cloud. The user exists. We move some of the components that are usually on a computer, like the input with the keyboard and the speakers, to the thin client. And now what we consider this kind of a remote control architecture, where the user with their thin client is remotely controlling the full browser and AT, just getting back the information they need. So if you think about non-visual access with this remote control metaphor, do we really even need to send back any of the pixels, right? So maybe we just need to send back the audio if that's what the user needs. And why this is relevant to this session, what's the difference really between me controlling my computer, say with a wireless keyboard, controlling my computer that's right in front of me with a wireless keyboard, and me controlling a remote computer a little bit farther away with a keyboard? It's not entirely clear. And then one of the final points in this presentation is about location. So we've kind of always talked about the cloud as it's this kind of thing that is either everywhere or nowhere. We don't really have to worry about that, but that's obviously not entirely true once we start thinking about policies that different locations might have. So if we think about somebody on one side of the world accessing content from another side of the world, and if they're doing that through the cloud, and something about the cloud-based assistive technology allows them to have different privileges than they would otherwise, that might be in violation of the local policies set up in their region, so in their country, province, municipality, etc. And so from our own experience, we've run into this from Web Anywhere appear to briefly be blocked from within China, for instance. And it's not just regional or geographic. So one solution to this might be to install little mini clouds within the borders that we're interested in to address some of these issues. But it's not just these geographic concerns. We've also hit upon another location that matters a lot to people, which is inside of different institutions like schools or companies. And so maybe we need inside of schools to have a local cloud that you can access within the school that respects whatever restrictions that school or whatever policies that school decides is necessary for their network. So just in summary, and I want to be quick, but there's a whole lot of different architectures that you could consider building cloud technology out of. And there's a lot of decisions to make and implications of those decisions and things in terms of the route that the content is being delivered through, the modifications that you might make to content, where you're making those modifications on the client computer, somewhere on remotely in the cloud, and then the location of the cloud technology itself, which it's really convenient to think of as not existing anywhere in particular, but I think when we start considering how cloud technology meshes with the various policy and legislation, then we have to start thinking about where these resources really physically reside. Okay, so that's all I have, and that's my long answer to your short question.
Thank you. And to clarify, two of the specific legal and regulatory hurdles that we've been discussing are, number one, a service like Web Anywhere might be found to be reproducing and performing someone's copyrighted works without their permission. So the question arises, is there a copyright issue here? The other issue that arises is a service like Web Anywhere sits in the middle of someone's personal web browsing, raising potential privacy issues that we need to deal with. So Gary, as someone with extensive international experience, can you talk a little bit about how the different laws of different countries and their different, how deeply they're into these issues, how that complicates all of this?
Right. I want to extend the analogy that of the cloud. So Jeff, nice going, and that map is really great. And so what I want to say is it depends which valley you're in underneath this cloud. And it's murky. In 1970, some of the first international research I was doing on disability was flying on a small plane from Beograd to a valley in Montenegro, Cetinje. And a Yugoslavensky fighter pilot was flying the plane, prop jet. And so think of electronics in those days. So we're in a cloud. We're above a cloud. We fly out of Yugoslavia. He's got his instrumentation. There's no instruments on the ground. He kind of calculates we're about there, and we go into a fighter pilot dive right through the cloud into a valley. And I'm a little terrified about this time. Where are we going? Because he goes into the valley, takes a steep banking turn, and back up into the cloud. Wrong valley. So we go over a little bit, and he goes into another power dive, and we go into a valley. And we go down, and there's a river coming out of the mountains. It's beautiful mountains on the border of Albania and Montenegro. And there's a cow pasture there with cows on it. So he goes down, and he buzzes the cows. And the cows run off the pasture, and he lands the plane. So I want to use that analogy to come to the cloud. It depends on which valley you're in. And if you take a look at the world, and the map right here, I liked your map because I remember sitting in Geneva one time doing some work, and I had a map above my desk. And the middle of the world was Geneva. And the United States is falling off one end, and China off the other. And I thought, it does make a difference where you're sitting and doing your work. So underneath this cloud are different valleys. And erase all national boundaries and think of place, social and physical place. So social and physical place, there's a book written by a very eminent geographer, Dutch, Harm de Bly, called The Power of Place. Erase all national boundaries and analyze the world in terms of technology, analyze it in terms of language, analyze it in terms of raw resources, and the world divides up into seven pieces. So what I want to talk about just for a minute is the interrelationship, and it depends on which valley you're in, between laws, customs, and practices. So come with me. The first place we're going is China. The Chinese character to learn means to copy. If you're in a socialist environment with a culture 5,000 years old, what you realize is the core value to who you are isn't a being an individual, it's what Don Wei do you belong to? Which work group? And the value of socialism is we share. We're in this together as a group. We share. So therefore, I remember being in China in 1982 leading a delegation and got into a library. And everything in my field and in medicine was there on the shelf, all pirated and Xeroxed. So what is a copyright law when you're from a culture where it's 5,000 years old, and who in the hell are you guys, being 150 years old, and the Chinese think in somewhere between 7 and 10 generations? So if you intervene now, you want to see the result in 7 to 10 generations. So when we come in with the cloud, and we come in and want to do joint ventures in China, we'd better pay attention that we're in a different valley. The second valley I want to take you to is the European Community and good old rainy Brussels. So I've been rattling around there for a while. And what becomes very clear when you hang out there and are talking to people in disability or technology, that they view the world a little differently too. If you ask them, are you capitalist? They surely are. Are you democracy? We're all democracies. But then you find out very quickly that you're in a different valley. Their form of capitalism and their form of democracy is divided into 28 minor valleys of all these other member nations, and they're all different valleys. What underlies the European community, as somebody mentioned earlier, is the European Human Rights Conventions, the UN Human Rights Conventions, and a notion of community, and a notion that there ought to be a balance somewhere between regulations, policies, customs, and practices. So, examples of that would be, if you're interested in education and special education and intellectually disabled people, and you start looking at education, how do you explain, beyond the flippant phrase, what we don't need around here are unions? And what we do need around here are lots of regulations and so forth, and go to Finland, which has the best performing educational system in the world right now. All teachers are unionized, and I could go on. We're in a different valley. The third example I would give you is in the United States. And if you take a look at our disability legislation here, it's basically based on human rights and the rights of the individual. So what I end up with is saying, it depends, if you're in the cloud, what valley you're diving into, and you'd better pay attention to the local culture or you're never going to get out of there, let alone perform.
Thank you. Elizabeth, could you tell us a little bit about how the National Broadband Plan addressed these issues? And if you're able to, a little bit about the 21st Century Act we've heard a lot about today.
Sure. No, I will try to
maybe even a preview of the notice that will be coming out tomorrow.
Oh, well. Wow, and I have 3 minutes? First of all, I just want to thank the Coleman Institute again for putting this together. This has just been a fascinating cross-disciplinary conversation today. And I don't know if you've been outside. It's actually absolutely gorgeous. And I'm very impressed that so many people of you are in here still. But that just sort of speaks to how nice this conversation has been. So I'm going to try to connect the National Broadband Plan to the conversations about cognitive disabilities, cloud computing, and throw in some stuff about the new legislation and the PN at the end. But first of all, you're probably saying, I think probably a lot of you, what is the National Broadband Plan? Probably remember the Stimulus Act last year, the Recovery Act, and its effect on one of our great infrastructure challenges. If you've been stuck in traffic, I mean, we've been doing lots of building of bridges and roads that spurred that. But it also concerned high-speed internet connections. And Congress tasked the FCC with coming up with a strategy of making high-speed internet available to all Americans. And I was lucky enough to be asked to think about and work with the team to consider about, focusing on accessibility for people with disabilities in high-speed internet access. And one of the things I'm very happy about that we were able to start doing, and we need to do a lot more work as a government agency, but over the years we have done lots of outreach to disability groups with hard of hearing and deaf, because we've been working on hearing aid compatibility, and telecommunication relay services. And when we did Section 255, which is about making telecom services and equipment accessible to people with disabilities, we started doing lots of outreach with blind groups. But I think for the first time, we had a hearing a year ago today, actually, a workshop in which we invited people from wide parts of the disability community. We had testimony from a woman with intellectual disabilities. We heard from someone from an autism community and someone who had a mobility disability, because there you have to look at every single different subcommunity within the disability community to understand the different needs and what the different barriers and opportunities are. And it's a start. I'm glad that we're starting to reach out, and I really want to work with all of you, all of us at the FCC, want to make sure that we continue to broaden the dialogue and reach out to all different sorts of groups. And one of the things we kept hearing over and over again is that, assistive technologies are really expensive. They're not interoperable with the technologies that we need. We can't keep up. What are some other creative ways that we need to think about? And so we tried to reach out and broaden the record and put out public notices. And so we did hear from lots of people. And some of those people are in the room today, people like Greg Vanderheiden. Dale Hatfield was also very important. But there were a coalition of people that said, if assistive technologies, assistive technologies as it traditionally is certainly still part of the solution. And we're not suggesting that we need to completely change the model, but we need to think expansively and broadly about how we can have new models such as cloud computing and other platforms to make assistive technologies affordable, widely available, and tap into the innovation of industry. And this is worthy of consideration. And these issues are hard for the federal government to wrap their mind around, but we need to think of ways to do this. And I think it made a real impression on those of us at the FCC. And so even though the accessibility recommendations they were integrated throughout the plan, but we had lots of editing done. But I will say that this idea was so powerful because of the broad support that it had, that people at all levels of the FTC said, you know, this is worthy of consideration, and we do need at least placeholder language in the broadband plan, at least as a jumping-off point for future endeavors and initiatives. And so I think that the broadband plan and cloud, I think cloud computing actually is addressed in three different ways within the broadband plan. I would say, you know, we basically had three different umbrellas of recommendations in the broadband plan. And the first one was that we need to get all the different agencies and government together that do these cross-cutting technology and accessibility issues. We need to get people together and work through these issues thoughtfully and holistically, instead of each of us having our own little silos, which we tend to be. And particularly at the FCC, we're an independent agency. We're not even part of the executive branch. And I think one of the things that has happened this fall, which I thought was terrific, is that the Interagency Council on Disability Research, which Sue is obviously a very big part of that, did convene a meeting to talk about cloud computing and profiles and got different stakeholders together, including people from across the government. And I think a lot more work needs to be done at the government. I think there needs to be coordination at all different levels of the government, but I thought it was a great first step that these issues were even being talked about in a way that I wasn't aware. Until the National Broadband Plan came up, I wasn't aware that any government agencies had been focused as a whole in a way to do that. So I think that's, you know, a great first step. We have a lot to do, but I think, you know, I think that we're moving in the right direction. And like I said, there was language saying some group of the executive branch should be doing, we should basically have a broadband accessibility working group. We should make the government itself a model of accessibility. We should be very focused on that. And the White House has made an announcement since then in July, getting together CIOs of all the different agencies trying to work on making government services and products more accessible. So I think in that first umbrella of getting the executive branch coordinated and thinking about these issues, you know, we're making progress. The second broad recommendation was that the FCC should start this accessibility and innovation initiative. And I think this is important because the vision of this is that we could also, there are all kinds of tools that as we as government policymakers ought to be employing to tackle these issues. We're a regulatory agency. We naturally think of regulation or way to do that. But I think the Accessibility and Innovation Initiative is a recognition that this should not be our only tool. And in fact, we should be using new media tools. We should be using workshops and field events to do lots of collaborative problem solving and bringing all the stakeholders together just to work through issues. And I think that this new Accessibility and Innovation Initiative, which Pam Gregory is the director of and Jamal Mesrui is the deputy director of, can be a platform in which we can discuss these kinds of issues and that we want to lend support. In fact, we three are here today as part of the Accessibility and Innovation Initiative to show that we think this is very important, we want to be engaged, we want to support efforts in the future, and this is why you know, tomorrow Pam and the Coleman Institute and Raising the Floor will, you know, take this a step further. I won't spoil any more surprise, but I think this is something really important that we want to continue to be engaged in. The third basic, umbrella of recommendation that also implicates cloud computing and will give me a hook to talk about the new legislation is that we need to update the regulations that we have to take into account, you know, modernizing, you know, take into account the new technologies that we have, the IP-enabled world that we live in. Instead of, you know, the FCC has traditionally only regulated telecommunications and stayed away from, you know, information or internet services. Well, I'm not going to say that we're regulating the internet because I don't think I'm allowed to say that. And that that's not a very, you know, useful.
I'm sure you're not allowed to say it.
Useful thing to say. But this new law modernizes, it goes beyond telecom services. We are regulating advanced services, which is surely some subset of information services beyond telecom services. And we will be exploring exactly what that area is and what we should be doing. But We will be covering new people that have never been covered and never have come to the FCC before, because the whole idea is to provide accessibility and to provide guarantees. I think I said, if you happened to be there earlier this morning, we at the FCC are committed to maximizing accessibility. We want to do this in the most efficient and innovative way possible, and recognize the importance of bringing all stakeholders to the table. So you want to, even if we are in regulatory mode, if we, you know, Congress told us we have to come out with new regulations, we want to do so in the most efficient and productive way that benefits people with accessibility. And just to give you sort of an example of how this might even tie back to cloud computing, one of the things that is different about the legislation compared to Section 255 is that it does provide for industry flexibility. You know, it says that industry can build in accessibility if that's the most efficient way to provide, maximize accessibility. But they also can use other tools to do so. For example, they can use third-party applications to achieve accessibility. So if this is the most sensible solution, that if as long as it does the job, and if the legislation provides that it must be done at nominal cost, it shouldn't be for people with disabilities to bear the cost of it. But let's be efficient and let's maximize efficient solutions. So I think that that could lead you back to how can cloud computing help? Well, if it's the most efficient way to bring third-party applications in, and that's the way to solve the problem, let's do it. Let's not get all caught up in the regulatory terminology here. Let's roll up our sleeves and figure out the best way to serve people. So I think that's how the National Broadband Plan addresses it, and I'm happy to answer any other questions.
That's great. Jeff, we want to help people, but we don't want to get in trouble with laws and regulations and stuff. Are there technology choices or architecture choices that can help reduce the risk?
I think we're still trying to sort that out. And part of the dinner we had last night that I think Greg mentioned earlier was to try to talk to people who are actually knowledgeable about the legal side of things. I think that some of the general rules that came out of that is to make yourself an unattractive target. You can do that in a number of ways. So don't do anything egregious. Don't keep copies of copyrighted material around. I think it was suggested that you don't keep any private information to the extent possible, don't keep any private or any information about the users who are accessing your services. But I think that there are technology choices we can make that impact these things, and I think that's one of the things we really need to focus on and think of very carefully about. And I'm really happy that we're starting to engage with people on these other disciplines who know a lot more about what we really should be caring about and what we shouldn't. Because I think another thing that came out of that dinner was that some of the things that I at least came in to the dinner thinking were very important were often not the most important things, and some other things I hadn't thought about were I guess more important. So keep that dialogue going. I think it's important.
Gary, what are your thoughts about how we can design and operate the cloud so that material can be available to people with disabilities across all of these boundaries in all the different valleys that you described?
It's a problem. And so what I wanted to talk about for a few minutes is some principles, and many of them we've discussed today. But I think, first of all, you recognize that there are different valleys, and there's different incentive systems, and you aren't going to change culture and geography in a very short time. So I'm really interested, Elizabeth, to have you here and talking about the FCC. I've been going to some regulatory hearings in Brussels because I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. You go in and listen to them talk about the problems there. And in the background is Microsoft and the rulings about Microsoft and so forth. And so it's a different sensitivity. And I think when you go in, you have to be sensitive to this, that the cloud can't develop without essentially people saying, well, let's go for it. And when you say, let's go for it, it's what Jeff is saying. Ultimately, you're an attorney. Ultimately, you're going to be skirting the boundaries of what's legal and illegal. And I think what Elizabeth is saying is some of that will have to be determined. And so getting to these principles, what I would say is the one thing we want to do is break down barriers. Another thing we do is, to have the cloud work, you have to have access. And I think also have some humility. So I would say, let's tamp down some arrogance and increase humility and realize, as this is my son saying, traveling with me a bit, boy, Dad, there are smart people everywhere. And I think that's very true. And so in terms of access, for instance, the most accessible internet I've seen in the last 12 months is in Malaysia. So you can connect to broadband, very high speed access to the internet in Malaysia for $1.56 a month. So you say, well, we don't want the government in here, we want free market. But the government, by having this plan of leapfrogging into the world, realized that it can't have a highly technical service economy without a stable financial system, without security, and without access to people who don't have much money. So it invested in this very rapid program to make high-speed internet access available to anybody. You put the cloud on top of this, and you've got everybody in rural Malaysia who, they're Linux programming, they're doing all kinds of stuff in rural villages. It's absolutely stunning. The other thing I would say is remote devices are everything. So on the technical side, and I'm not a techie, but everywhere I go where there's smart people, I'll be damned with $1.35, they're connected to the rest of the world. And they figure out some way to do that through cell phones, through old laptops. In China, what I found was really amazing is in places that didn't have much money, is they just took bucketfuls apart. And it's Bill Gates in the garage. And what they were doing is taking a little bit of French and a little an Intel chip here and a whatever there and building their own equipment for almost nothing. Just throwaway parts. So what I'm getting at there is access. Both in terms of we have a cloud, and if we have the cloud operating, you have to have people be able to get to the cloud. So one of that is, through all the stuff you were saying, which is really true, is we can manipulate that in the cloud so that you can say, I give you my designer access code. And if you have access to the internet and you have any kind of a device, you're in. So I say, that all over the world cheap. And that's being done right now. The other thing is transparency. What's really a problem all over the world is, who owns this cloud? So we had the discussion earlier, what is the cloud? Who owns the cloud? Who controls the cloud? Is Bill, when he was here talking about standards, that the government makes one set of dictates, it unstabilizes the playing field. How do we have a net neutrality but one piece of this? So transparency. And if we move into cognitive disability, then we start getting into psychopharmacology. And we start getting into all kinds of things. So I heard something kind of shocking the other day, is that a public interest group has just come out with a report. They did this study in the United States of the 7 largest pharmaceutical companies here and found out that they had spent $273 million in the last 18 months, well, this is lagged by about 6 months, on physician consultants to speak, to market for them, to do whatever. And then they did a random sample of these physicians, and they discovered that a significant percentage did not have boards in the field in which they were advertising, were on state registries of having been engaged in fraudulent activity and had their licenses revoked. And so if you go down this line and you go around the world in the cloud, if I'm sitting there in rural Malaysia and I'm smart and have access, and in fact I've got a cognitively disabled person in my family, how do I know where this information is coming from? Who's profiting by it, and whether I should believe it? So I forget who it was talking about their mother. My father, before he died, would always call me up, and he had macular degeneration. And he couldn't sleep, so he'd be up all night listening to radio broadcasts from all over, and anything in English, to alleviate his boredom. And he'd say, Gary, have you heard about... I hadn't heard about it. I said, Dad, I've been working. I didn't. But he said, what am I to believe? And so it's transparency. Who do you trust? And the transparency is in today's political campaign. Who's paying for all these ads? Oh, it's a democracy. We aren't going to tell you. And so if we don't have transparency and we don't have access and you don't know who to trust, this cloud's going nowhere. The next point I would make, and this is from experience I've had in National Institutes of Health and also on European funding bodies for research, is we're getting to a point, and Sue and I had just a brief conversation about that, Sue, and that is, she was telling me, I said, hey, Sue, what are you doing? She said, well, we used to fund all these double-blinded clinical trials and so forth, and people would send in very highly technical proposals in an area in which we already know an awful lot about what's to be learned. So why don't we come over here and have less methodology and ask questions in areas where we really need to know something. So what I'm saying, in terms of efficacy, what works? And so one of the things we want to do in the cloud is find out, and there's been some discussion earlier about that, is what's really important is to, we don't know, and this is where somebody's going to make a lot of money, we don't know what aspects of the cloud are going to work or in which valleys. But I think what we need to pay a lot of attention to is what works. Not what we can market, not what we can profit from, what works. Well, then you have to define what works mean. And then I would finish by saying, this is tamp down the arrogance and pump up what's there. It's important to know what's going on in the rest of the world. And so a little vignette of that is I was in Singapore not very long, just some months ago. And in Singapore, thou shalt not chew gum, spit it on the street, throw cigarette butts on the street, and thou shalt not jaywalk. So I was caught, my wife and I are staying in a hotel here, going to dinner here, and had to wait for four different traffic lights to get there. Okay, so we're there, I'm kind of talking to her, and I hear this conversation going on behind me that was just fabulous. It's one of my big experiences of the last year. So I didn't turn around, so I didn't want to disturb it. So the conversation is between three Asians. And the two young guys are saying to some guy about late 30s, hey, how'd Redmond go? I'm in Singapore on the street. I grew up in Bellevue, Washington, less than a mile from Bill Gates where he grew up and where he lives today, and grew up in this environment. So for me, Redmond, you know, how'd Redmond go? And so the guy said, it was really kind of fun. He said, I learned a lot. And he said, you know, when you go to the United States, and you guys will get there, and you go to 128, or you go to Silicon Valley, or you go to Redmond, he said, you got to be prepared for a cultural difference. And they said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I had this meeting, and he said, I walk in, and the guy's in jeans and a t-shirt, and I said, I was kind of ready for that. And he says, hi, I'm Jack, pseudonym. He said, you know, in the area we're working in, I'm probably the best guy in the world. And the most knowledgeable. And these other two guys said, well, what'd you say? And I said, well, that's what I've heard. So, now, these guys are working, and I just spent the day at the National University of Singapore. And it has a huge industrial park around there, those of you who know, with everybody you'd ever want to have there. And these guys are going 24 hours a day. The lights are on. And they go in shifts because they're connected to the rest of the world. So this conversation goes on, and one guy said, well, how much better are they at Microsoft than some of the stuff we're doing here? And he said, not as much as they would like to think. So I go on in that vein then, and so what's going on in cognitive disability that's really interesting is that technically that's going on in Kuala Lumpur. It's going off in rural Ireland, where these guys are all writing computer code. It's going off in Poland. I've never seen such nasty computer viruses that come out of Russia because these guys have to learn to write on very, very small CPUs. They're elegant programmers. And when you get into this kind of a world, what's going on? For over 20 years now, the World Health Organization has had a program in community-based rehabilitation. The World Bank has had, under James Wolfensohn, hired Amartya Sen as a consultant. And Amartya Sen sold James Wolfensohn. James Wolfensohn is Australian. And he was a commercial big-time banker. And this guy knows the world. And when he came to the World Bank, he didn't want to make money. He wanted to make a difference. One of the things he did is started a group on disability. And Amartya Sen, both as an economist and a philosopher on theories of justice, and also his stuff on developmental economics, has the idea, and he sold it to Wolfensohn, that disability is an economic issue in development. And if you don't take care of disability, prevention, primary, and along the line, you're going to retard yourself by somewhere between 7 and 18% of GDP per year in development growth over a period of 10 years because you've got all these people that are, quote, aren't productive. And then I would pay attention to what's going on in the huge revolutions in healthcare and in Europe right now and in the whole revolution in the National Health Service about where disability fits in there. So we don't need to go out and invent a computer chip. Yes, there are people out there who are smart. Yes, other countries are doing things, and we might not want to buy them, but we at least ought to know they're going on.
Thank you. Elizabeth, you and your colleagues have done a great job so far. How can we get other public policy makers to understand the need to focus on access for people with disabilities?
Well, I guess I would say there are two things. We should both build bridges and break things down so people can understand it. So, and this is a point that Sue was making earlier this morning. But as far as building bridges, I think it's really important that what we're trying to do here is not seen as, or is in fact, some kind of insular movement. And I think there are two important ways to reach out and make sure that this happens. One is to do exactly what we're doing here today, which is to have these cross-disciplinary partnerships so we can start to learn from each other all the different complex pieces there are. The other way I think that is really important, too, is to make bridges to people that don't make a career choice to go into accessibility, but to get people that have a broader range of things that they're devoting their life to make accessibility a part of what they're doing. So, for example, the Wireless Bureau is taking on a lot of the responsibility for implementing some of the new rules, or at least pieces of it. And I'm working to recruit young attorneys who have been working at various, you know, innovation, internet kinds of issues. I said, look, this is something that you ought to get involved in and make it part of your portfolio. And it's a very interesting way to connect to different pieces. And it's, you know, very important for what we're doing to connect to people like Vint Cerf, Dale Hatfield, even Preston Patton. I mean, get people who have done a lot of different things with their career and make them your allies. So I think that's a really, this is something that I urge us to do as we're trying to move forward. And that goes to sort of the next point of breaking it down for more general policymakers, because these people are not focused their entire career or what they're doing on accessibility, but it's really important for them to understand how it fits into their bigger agendas and bigger goals. And so I think it's really important to have a very practical vision that people can understand. And it's both making it bigger to connect to some of their larger goals, whether it's, hey, cloud computing is important because it promotes healthcare and education and public safety and civic participation, and all the bigger goals that public policymakers might want to be interested in. So it's important to make it bigger at that level and tie it to other national purposes. On the other hand, I think what you have to do is make it smaller in a way that people can understand and put it into sort of bite-sized chunks. If we want to have a vision of getting this cloud computing, all right, well, what people will need to see are pilot projects that show how this really works in a hands-on way, and say so it's not just sort of an amorphous vision, but something that's tangible and doable, and show people what it is, and show, you know, how it can affect. And I think, you know, the film that Greg was showing earlier is very, you know, helpful and powerful because it shows, okay, this is why this is important for Granny, and this is what exactly what we're talking about. I mean, having that kind of specific vision is very helpful. Anything that's tangible, so people can see in their mind, oh, this is the deliverable, and this is how I can talk about it in my, you know, 30-second soundbite when I'm trying to brief my boss, because I think, you know, people need to be able to break it down that way. And then, obviously, people at different levels can delve down deeper and get the details that they need to make things work. But I think if you want to get high-level policy support, which at the end of the day is how you're going to get government funding, you need to tie it to bigger, broader policy goals, enlist mainstream support, show that it's a cross-disciplinary initiative, and have, you know, a plan for how you, if you're going to have a vision or something that's going to happen in 10 or 20 years, What's going to happen at year one? What's going to happen at year three? What's going to happen at year five? What are some pilot projects? I think these things will make this more tangible and doable for policymakers.
Great. Clayton, I think we're 5 minutes over. Do you want us to take a couple of questions or just say good evening?
I think we can do that. Okay. We certainly can do it. So we've actually managed to stay almost within schedule. So that gives us the luxury of taking a little bit of time here. We do have a reception coming up at 5:15, Anna, is that right?
Yeah, just the reception.
Do you know if it's already set? Okay, so we'll try to telescope things a little bit, but we do have time for a question or two.
Could I just...
Sure.
I'd just like to acknowledge Anna and her usual spectacular job in taking care of everything. And, she consistently makes us look good, and it's not easy.
So Anna and then the Yahoo guy and up here. Okay, go ahead.
It's kind of discouraging because what I have been doing, yes, is thinking about. I wrote a book called The Disability Business in 1992. I'd been on the faculty at the Kellogg School at Northwestern for a whole number of years. And one of the things that really I found bothersome is that I was teaching some of the smartest students I'd come across in the world and from all over the world, many, many countries represented. So it's like Harvard, Stanford Business School, North Kellogg School. To make a hell of a lot of money off other people's miseries. And I found this very distasteful. So I just said it didn't fit with my personality. So I changed jobs, and I spent the rest of my career, that's where I saw AC, and that's where I met David, in a school of public health, because I thought I'd rather be less wired into the business elite and teach people to make money and to expand markets than I would be to try and help people live better lives. And so right about that time, and that's where I learned a fair amount about finance and so forth, being in that environment, and we were consulting with all kinds of top corporations around the world, is I got the idea for the disability business. So I thought, well, I'll write a book on the political economy of disability in the United States. So since then, what I've been doing in Europe, and also these little forays in Asia, is doing homework for a global book on that. And it's Woody Allen, Follow the Money. And what I find very interesting from, you want to get good health care in the world, you can go just about anywhere. Bangkok has wonderful health care and on it goes. What I find really interesting, though, is the different valleys underneath the cloud. So in the United States, this was my book, and it's become more so, it's really clear that medicine health is a for-profit business. And so follow the money. Where in other countries, they're struggling with all these different value sets that I was talking about. And so, yes, indeed, I've been thinking about it. And yes, indeed, you can begin to get a little flavor from what I was saying today, the way I've been thinking.
Up here.
There's also an event on November 8th
find out about all of the projects that the FCC is looking at. It seems like it's almost
kind of spread out.
I keep hearing about all these different things.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. And what we have just recently launched our Accessibility and Innovation Initiative, and close to the top of our list is to really beef up. There is an Accessibility and Innovation website now that will provide some of this information, but it needs to. It will, in the near future, be beefed up and really consolidated. So it will be one-stop shopping. We're not there yet, but it's. We know that it needs to be done.
What I'm seeing so far is a grassroots effort to get communities and companies to work together. Is that going to be something that you're going to encourage more of?
Yes, I think. We have a lot on our plate right now, but we are determined to move forward on all fronts as we're implementing the legislation to move forward with our Accessibility and Innovation Initiative, which is why I was just so glad that we announced last week that Pam's going to be leading that along with Jamal, and really move forward on the efforts of not only having one-stop shopping on our website, but planning different additional field events, workshops, and then really trying to figure out how we can get our best bang for the buck. I mean, we have to be thoughtful about it. We can't do everything that we want all at once, but we need to work with everyone to try to figure out how we can add the most value.
There's a question up here.
One thing I would say is that people have become increasingly aware, just in general, of usability in computer systems over the last few decades, right? And I think that's only increasing. And I actually thought it was very interesting. A lot of what you hear as very important guidelines for accessibility for people with cognitive impairments actually matches pretty closely to what you learn as just general usability guidelines, right? So. You want to make things as simple as possible, allow people to do what they need to do. The tasks should be efficient. You should design your interfaces so that they can allow you to get things done efficiently, and things like that. And so, in that sense, I think you're right, and I think that the profession, usability profession, has become increasingly important over the last few decades, and that seems only likely to increase. It seems like a lot of what people in that field are doing definitely applies to people with cognitive impairments. And so hopefully, we'll all get better interfaces out of it.
Okay. Mike?
I just had one quick comment about the architecture diagram in particular. I just think that emphasized it for me in this conference. The piece that's missing in all this, from my experience, is human beings on the service end. But as I say, the internet allows families, allows volunteers, allows other social networks to participate and provide services and back up what we normally think of as support services. Thinking of Greg Van der Heijden's Try Harder stuff, effective finding retreats to a human being. If you can't figure out how to